The Years of Lyndon Johnson, Means of Ascent, by Robert A. Caro, continued, Cassette 9, Side 2. At almost every stop, Woodward says, there was someone he had done something for. The favorable cards, and that remarkable memory, enabled him now to make the most of what he had done. Someone would introduce himself and say, "Lyndon, do you remember my boy John? You helped him get his disability." "I sure do. I'm glad I could help him. What's he doing now? How's he coming?" And when the man had told him, he would say, "That's good." Or, "Is there anything I can do for him?" And, "How's your missus?" Or they would ask him for new favors. "Lyndon, my boy, you know he was in the service and he was hit in the leg. I need him to help out on the farm, but Lyndon, he can't plow, and they say he can't get any disability, and I don't think they're doing right by him." And Johnson would turn to Woodward, who would be standing there with his notebook. "Woody, get that boy's name, and we'll look right into it." The rapport was cemented, or if there had been no previous connection created, with physical affection, with hands and eyes, or in the case of women, quite often with kisses. He would call older women mother or grandma, even if he had never met them before, and hug and kiss them, and say a fond, respectful word to them. Often when he would reach out to hug a woman, she would giggle and back away, and when he had kissed one and the other women saw what was coming, they would retreat out of his path. But he would come after them, recalls a man who watched this. He'd go across the room after them. And when he caught them, Lyndon Johnson would take one of their hands in his and put his other around their shoulder and bend down and kiss their cheek, and these elderly farm women would receive the kiss, scrunched down a little in embarrassment with their faces turned away, but with their faces aglow. You could see they just loved this attention. With men, the rapport was cemented with a handshake, and a handshake as delivered by Lyndon Johnson could be as effective as a hug. "Now, July 24th is primary day," he would say, "and I hope you will lend me your helping hand." And he would reach out and grasp the farmer's hand, looking down into his eyes. "What's your name?" he would ask. "Where are you from? What's your occupation?" And he would always have a relevant sentence or two ready to add. If the farmer said he had two sons, Lyndon would ask what they were doing, and if the farmer said they were studying agriculture at a college, Johnson would say, "Well, they're learning a lot of good things there, but people like you who know the land know stuff they can't learn from teaching, don't you?" Sometimes, in the midst of a crowd of strangers, he would stop and concentrate on a single person, as if he were back in a little hill country town again, running for Congress for the first time, and talking to a man he knew. He wouldn't take the man's hand at first. "Listen," he would say, standing before the man and looking into his eyes, his own face glistening with perspiration, his cheeks hollow with fatigue and the shirt clinging to his body. "Listen, you know why I'm running for the Senate. I want your support. I want your vote. I hear tell that all the people down in your neck of the woods will listen to what you tell them. Will you tell them to vote for me? I need help. Will you help me? Will you give me your helping hand?" "Will you give me your helping hand?" As he asked that final question, Lyndon Johnson would raise his own hand and hold it out in a mute appeal. When Johnson was only 21, participating in his first political campaign, State Senator Welly Hopkins had concluded that the tall, gangling college boy had a gift, a very unusual ability to meet and greet the public. Time after time now, Lyndon Johnson's hand would reach out to a voter, and the voter's hand would reach out in return. The hands with which he was doing this were terribly cracked now. Dry and scaly as they had been before the campaign because of his eczema, the sun had baked them drier. They looked almost like cracked leather marked with narrow lines of blood, for new cracks, deep, painful little knife-like slits, were constantly appearing in the skin. And many of the hands he was shaking were the hands of farmers, hard and strong, the hands of men who had worked with their hands all their lives. "Without meaning to, they hurt," says Horace Busby. And sometimes in the crush after a speech, Johnson would momentarily forget to use the two-handed method, or someone would grab his hand while he was still concentrating on someone else. Once Busby was standing on the ground next to a flatbed truck, with steps on both ends, on which Johnson was shaking hands with members of the audience as they came up on the truck and filed past him. "All of a sudden I heard the damnedest yelp like a dog had been hit." Busby looked up, and Lyndon Johnson was down on one knee. He'd been shaking hands with a big old guy in coveralls and a white shirt. But as the young speechwriter watched, Johnson recovered himself and smiled at the farmer, and turned with a smile to the next person in line, and the next. At every stop, no matter how much it might hurt him to shake hands, he shook every one. He shook even those that were not offered to him. In small towns, there was usually a little group of elderly men, the domino players from the courthouse square, who would stand at the back of the crowd during the speech, and after it would not approach the candidate, showing by the reserved look on their faces that they were not impressed by any politician. Of course, elderly men like these were almost invariably Stevenson supporters. But when Johnson noticed such a group of men, he would, after he had shaken everyone else's hands, walk over to where they were standing to shake theirs, his cracked hand held out, and a broad, pleasant smile on his face. His voice was cracked, too, and the throat sprays were not helping much more than the ointments were helping his hands. By the end of each day it was a hoarse croak, but every time it seemed to be about to give out entirely, it would come back. He was so tired. After spending July 15th accompanying Johnson on a tour of the 4th Congressional District in northeast Texas, District Chairman Fred Meredith asked Claude Wilde to show the candidate mercy. "He had a mighty hard schedule that day," Meredith wrote. "Upon arrival in Greenville that evening, we noticed the telling effects of this hard drive upon him. I don't know but what it would be well for John Connally and you to try to have him make fewer appearances for the balance of the campaign, because you're driving him to death." In his reply, Wilde didn't even respond to the suggestion about fewer appearances. What would have been the use? It wasn't his campaign manager who was driving Lyndon Johnson. Once in these final weeks before the July 24th primary, the candidate was so tired that during his noon stop at a hotel, he decided to take a half-hour nap. Changing into pajamas, he went to sleep. His aides, who'd been watching with concern the toll being exacted from him, did not awaken him for 2 hours. When they did, his first look was at his wristwatch. His face tightened. He didn't take a nap like that again. Thereafter, as before, napping was something he did in the helicopter. He would shout at Mashman over the roar of the engine, "Joe, I'm just too tired. I've got to rest." A moment later, he would be asleep. He slept sitting up, of course, since that tiny cockpit had no room in which to lie down. 2 24-inch-wide bucket seats occupied most of its 60-inch width. Between each seat and the door next to it, or the opening where the door would have been, had there been a door, was a space of 2.5 inches. As Johnson sat cramped in his seat, one set of the dual controls was between his knees, so that as he slept, held upright by his seatbelt, his head slumping forward on his chest, his long legs were sort of wrapped around the controls, his right arm all but out the open door. There was so much noise, and the cockpit would be shaking and vibrating, and the doors were off so the wind was whistling through it. The sun shining through the unshaded plexiglass made the inside of the bubble glaringly bright. But Johnson would be sleeping, sometimes with his Stetson pulled down over his eyes for shade, sometimes with the hat still on the floor where an aide had placed it. Mashman found it incredible that anyone could sleep in such conditions, but he realized his passenger was just too tired to stay awake. Sometimes Johnson, in the moment before he went to sleep, would tell Mashman, "We're going to fly over this town, and if you want to, slow down there, and you can just say whatever you want, but I'm just too tired." He had found that Mashman could speak over the microphone, and the quality of the sound system ensured that no one on the ground would be able to tell who was really talking to them. So when the helicopter reached the town, Johnson would go on sleeping while Mashman, circling and hovering, would say through the microphone, "Hello down there, this is your friend Lyndon Johnson, asking you to vote for me in this forthcoming election. This is Congressman Lyndon Johnson speaking, hopefully your next senator. We're sorry we can't land, but we're thinking about you." The blare of the public address system amplifier, lashed to the helicopter only a foot or two behind Johnson, had no more effect on him than the roar of the engine or the vibration. As Mashman proclaimed, "This is Lyndon Johnson speaking," Lyndon Johnson slept on. Having completed his spiel, Mashman would climb and soar away. Glancing over at the exhausted man beside him, Mashman noticed how the sun pouring down on him made even sharper the grooves clawed into his cheeks by fatigue, and deepened the dark, almost purple shadows under his eyes. It glinted off the slits of blood on his hands. But as Lyndon Johnson slept in that cockpit filled with sun, he never blinked. Johnson would never sleep for more than half an hour, Mashman recalls. Then in an instant he would be wide awake, and his first question, shouted over the engine noise, would be, "Are we on schedule, Joe? Or how are we doing on time? Or when are we going to get there?" And if the answer wasn't satisfactory, "Well, come on, we've got to get there, you know. Come on." During these 3 weeks from the 4th of July weekend to primary day, Mashman had a unique view of what the pilot calls Lyndon Johnson's single-mindedness, his concentration, his determination. Words that are inadequate to describe either the intensity with which his passenger was focusing on his goal, an intensity that left no room for other considerations, or the ferocity with which he was fighting to reach it. Mashman's view was unique because he alone flew with Lyndon Johnson during these weeks. He had been surprised, as had his predecessor Tudors, by Johnson's total lack of interest in the helicopter. By the way, in an era in which helicopters were so new and unproven that even many seasoned pilots shunned them, the congressman had just got on and said, "Let's go," the first time he had seen the aircraft, burying himself in his briefing papers and staying buried in them. Flying in the Bell was a substantially different experience from flying in the far larger Sikorsky. It vibrated much more and was noisier. Moreover, instead of sitting in a cockpit that resembled the cabin of a small airplane, a passenger was sitting, surrounded only by glass, as if he were simply perched 500 or 1,000 feet up in the air. But Johnson seemed not to notice. During these weeks, Mashman feels, he came to understand the congressman's lack of interest. The helicopter, he says, echoing the same words that Tudors uses, was to Johnson only a means to an end, the end being victory. This end, Mashman came to see, was so all-consuming that the means mattered not at all. No consideration that might interfere with victory could be allowed to intrude. Not even personal safety. Because of Lyndon Johnson, during these 3 weeks, Mashman flew constantly on a razor-thin margin of safety. "He would urge you on," Mashman says. "He had a knack of getting everything there was to get out of you." And the pilot says, "In the field of aviation, that's a very dangerous thing." Mashman says that if he pushed you to the point whereby he was definitely wrong in doing so, and you definitely couldn't do it, if you just stopped and laid it on the line and said, "I don't think this is a safe thing to do, that we just can't do it, period," then he would back down and say, "All right, you're the boss." Nonetheless, as day followed day and Johnson pushed harder and harder, the point at which Mashman stopped edged closer and closer to the limits of safety. The very act of inching off from inadequate landing sites with a too heavy load, wavering in the air a few feet above the ground and then a few feet higher, and then struggling up into the sky, might have been disconcerting to the average passenger, but Johnson's only concern during such moments was in weighing the waste of time involved in this experimenting against the waste of time involved if he told Mashman to set down and let him out so that he could be driven to a rendezvous with the helicopter outside town. His only concern was which method would get him to the next town, the next audience of voters, faster. The margin of daylight was another source of concern to Mashman, and under Johnson's prodding, the pilot was constantly slicing that margin thinner and thinner. Since the helicopter was not equipped with night-flying instruments, Mashman had at first insisted that the campaign schedule allow him to be on the ground well before dark. Johnson was determined to cram the maximum number of campaign appearances into each day, and often he would run behind schedule. As the afternoon drew into evening, aides would warn him that daylight was running out, but the warnings were ignored. Mashman found himself landing later and later, often in the dusk, just as darkness was becoming total. Years later, the pilot was to recall vividly the times he came in for a landing when he could barely see the ground. Under Johnson's prodding, moreover, Warren Woodward was selecting tighter and tighter landing sites. One was located in Rosenberg, a small city of 4,800 residents about 30 miles west of Houston. There, Woodward had been unable to find, near the center of town, even a lawn large enough for the 47D to set down on. The only sizable flat area was the roof of a B.F. Goodrich service station, so Woodward ordered Mashman to land on the service station. No one was really sure if the roof would bear the helicopter's weight, and at the last minute Woodward had the roof shored up with beams hauled from a local lumber yard in wagons pulled by mule teams. The beams were in place just when the helicopter started to descend, but Mashman was more than a little worried about what would happen when his full weight settled on the roof. His passenger, however, was not. During Mashman's slow, anxious descent, Johnson lifted his head from his perusal of his notes for a single glance at the satisfactorily sizable crowd gathered to watch the daredevil landing. When they were down, his only reaction to the risk that had been taken was pleasure. The smile he turned on Woodward was, for once, wholly uncritical. That's my can-do boy, he said. Storms, even the violent late-afternoon Texas thunderstorms, were to Johnson nothing but an annoyance, an obstacle between him and his goal. Ahead of the helicopter, suddenly, one of those mighty columns of swirling blackness would loom up 30 or 40,000 feet high. Mashman might venture to mention it to his passenger. "Well, just keep on going," Lyndon Johnson would say. "We've got to get there." Willing though the pilot was to fly through a storm's turbulence, sometimes he would feel that the danger was simply too great because of the lack of visibility. He would be unable to see the ground, or even more than a few feet ahead, and of course the little craft was not equipped to fly on instruments. If he told Johnson he couldn't proceed, Johnson's initial response would be, "Well, are you sure now?" If Mashman said he was, Johnson would defer to his judgment. Sometimes they would wait, hoping the storm would move away, hovering in midair close to its edge. At other times, the pilot would try to circle the storm and fly on to the next town, skipping one stop, with Johnson adjuring him to circle the storm as closely as possible so as not to lose a single unnecessary minute. But more and more often, as the weight of Johnson's personality bore on Mashman's, the pilot found himself deciding to try to get through such storms by flying under them where he could see the ground. In order to see it in the heavy rain, Mashman might have to descend as low as 5 feet off the ground, and would just inch along slower and slower, sometimes as slow as 15 miles per hour, peering ahead through the sheets of rain to look for any obstacles, a building or an electric telephone wire. "Many times we actually flew under high-tension wires," Mashman recalls. "And all the time, of course, hanging above them was that mass of black clouds." The pilot himself was often a little shaky during such maneuvers, but his passenger wasn't. All he wanted to know was, "Are we going to get there on time?" It wasn't, Mashman came to realize, that his passenger was weighing various considerations against the political necessities of the moment, such as getting to a rally on time or cramming in one more stop before dark. Rather, it was that in his passenger's mind there were no other considerations. Mashman came to understand this fully after an incident in Marshall, Lady Bird Johnson's high school hometown, on July 14th. The incident was the result of a form of stalling. Its technical name was settling with power, that occasionally occurred during those early days of helicopter flying. This stalling was caused by a combination of extremely hot weather, which reduced the engine's power, and a sudden shift in the wind when a helicopter was flying at a low altitude, so that the blades find no purchase in the air, and, as Mashman puts it, the ship just begins to drop like a brick. This phenomenon, which would be corrected in later generations of helicopters by a simple change in the angle of the rotor blades, was extremely rare. Mashman himself had never experienced it, and the first time he encountered it, he did not realize what was happening. All he knew was that as he was flying at a height of between 25 and 30 feet along Marshall's main street on his way to a landing site in a park, with Johnson sitting beside him, studying his briefing papers, without warning, the ship just dropped out from under me. He had lost power completely. His reaction was to jerk the controls toward him, a maneuver whose only effect was to cause the helicopter to pitch forward and drop even faster. As he sat there, with a feeling of complete helplessness, the helicopter fell like a stone, hitting the ground between two parked cars so hard that it bounced up into the air over one of the cars. Suddenly, Mashman found that he had power again. He regained control and continued flying to the park. After they landed, just before Johnson stepped out to begin a speech, he said, "Joe, that wasn't where you wanted to land back there, was it?" His tone was one of mild curiosity. "No, no," Mashman replied. "We had a little problem. I'll tell you about it later." While Johnson was speaking, Mashman was preparing an explanation of what had happened, but in fact, no explanation was required. Climbing back into the helicopter after the speech, Johnson immediately opened his next set of briefing papers and didn't ask about the sudden drop to the ground. He never asked. The helicopter in which Lyndon Johnson had been riding had fallen like a stone for 25 feet, had hit the ground so hard that it bounced higher than a car roof, and then, regaining power, had swooped up into the air again. And, Mashman realized, Johnson hadn't really noticed. At 6:30 on the morning of July 24th, primary day, George Parr came to the home of his feared Mexican-American enforcer, Indio Salas, and repeated his instructions. "Concentrate on the Senate race. Be sure we elect Johnson." Salas, as election judge, presided over Precinct 13, the Mexican-American district of Alice, the county seat of Jim Wells County, where the polling place had, as usual, been set up in a large room in the Nair Elementary School. In a vacant lot across the street from the school, Salas had arranged for the erection of the traditional Election Day tent, pyramid-shaped, about 16 feet square at the base, and in front of it stood deputy sheriffs wearing guns. It had been set up so that the Mexican-American voters who were herded into it by other deputies could be given their poll tax receipts, their sample ballots or strings, and their instructions in privacy. "Inside we had a table," Salas recalls, "with plenty sample ballots to teach some of our voters how to vote. Lots of them needed training." There was a new development. Under Texas election law, each party was permitted poll watchers to inspect the ballots, and the Jim Wells reformers, emboldened by recent successes, had actually dared to name two for Box 13, H.L. Ike Poole and young Jimmy Holmgreen. And when they arrived at the Nair School, just as the polls were opening at 7 a.m., they handed Salas a paper, a judge's order designed to ensure an honest vote. But in George Parr's precincts, the law was not what was written on paper. Salas pointed to two chairs that he thought were far enough away from the table on which the ballots were counted so that the reformers could not get a good look at them. "I just ordered them to go sit in a corner and keep out of the way," Salas was to recall. "I tell you once more, I was so powerful I could do anything that pleased me." Then he whispered to the election clerks, told them, "Absolutely do not let them see the ballots." Poole, Salas was to say, more or less obeyed his orders, but Holmgreen objected when he saw Mexican-American voters pull out sample ballots and refer to them while marking their own, an obvious violation of the election law. Before noon, Salas began counting the ballots. Sitting at a table, he unfolded each ballot and called out the names on it. Three clerks sitting at the same table marked down the votes on three separate tally sheets. Even from his chair in the corner, Holmgreen was to say, he could see the marks on the ballots, and he saw Salas calling out for Johnson votes that were actually for Stevenson. A brave young man, Holmgreen kept asking to inspect the ballots, as he was entitled by law to do. "He was up many times approaching the desk where the clerks were counting and reading the ballots," Salas says. "I told him better sit down." When Holmgreen persisted, Deputy Sheriff Stokes Meisenheimer, a huge man, as fat as any cinema caricature of a Deep South deputy, with his belly bulging over his gun belt, arrested him, marched him off to the city jail, and locked him in a cell. An attorney for the reformers obtained a writ of mandamus, freeing Holmgreen and ordering Salas to allow the poll watchers to see the ballots. "I just ignored same, and again told Poole and Holmgreen, you just stay put, don't move from your chairs." Shortly after the polls closed at 7 p.m., Salas announced the vote in Precinct 13. That single box furnished Johnson with the bulk of his 1,881 to 1,357 lead in Jim Wells County. And no reform opposition to Parr existed in the six counties, Duval, Starr, LaSalle, Brooks, Jim Hogg, and Zapata, controlled absolutely by the Duke of Duval. In Duval, Stevenson received 66 votes, Petty 20, Johnson 3,707, 98% of the total. In the six counties as a whole, Johnson received 90% of the total. His plurality over Stevenson in Parr's domain totaled almost 7,000 votes. In Judge Raymond's Webb County, he received 90% of the total, and a plurality over Stevenson of almost 6,000 votes. The districts of Corpus Christi that Anglo politicians called Mextown and Niggertown produced 4,000 more. Those in McAllen and Edinburgh on the border weighed in with more. Although San Antonio's west side didn't produce as well for Johnson as had been expected, he nonetheless came out of that city and the valley with the 25,000 votes he had expected. Even including this block vote, however, Lyndon Johnson polled only 405,617 votes, 34% of the total. Coke Stevenson had 477,077 votes, or 40%. Petty had 237,195 votes, or 20%, and the eight minor candidates had 83,000 votes, 7%. Stevenson would have won without the necessity of a second primary, had his fellow conservative George Petty not polled an unexpectedly high total, largely, in the opinion of political observers, because of a mistake by the conservatives' daily Bible, the Dallas News, which the day before the election confident that its favorite Stevenson would win even with a split vote, had loftily assured conservatives that they could vote for either Stevenson or Petty without hurting the conservative cause. Despite the conservative split, Stevenson had defeated Johnson by 71,000 votes. And when the second runoff primary was held on August 28th, Petty would be gone from the race. Political writers and observers agreed with virtual unanimity that Petty's voters would now turn to the remaining conservative candidate. Voters in the 14 fiercely conservative East Texas counties that Petty had carried were hardly likely to switch to the candidate identified as a liberal. This assessment was echoed not only by newspapers, liberal and conservative alike, throughout the state, but in Johnson's own camp, stunned by the extent of his defeat. The shock was intensified for the younger Johnson aides, those who worked out of the Hancock House, because a last-minute Belden poll, released on primary day, had, in contrast to earlier Belden polls, shown that among most likely voters whose preference had been decided, Johnson had actually pulled ahead of Stevenson. The dramatic inaccuracy of this poll confirmed the feeling of the senior Johnson advisers, the Brown Building Group, and of other Texas political observers that, in those relatively early days of polling in that state, identifying and predicting the preference of most likely voters was not reliable. The Brown Building Group had not put much stock in the last-minute poll, which was, of course, at variance not only with their own private polls, but, indeed, with virtually all informed Texas political opinion. Stevenson's campaign manager, Morris Roberts, predicted that Stevenson would win 90% of Petty's vote. This is only natural. The principles laid down by both Mr. Stevenson and Mr. Petty are so closely identical it would be difficult to find a dividing line. And in the somber discussions at the Hancock House and in the Brown Building, the consensus was that Roberts' estimate might not be too far off. The Johnson team had been confident that their chief would run close to old Coke in the first primary, close enough so that Johnson would have a realistic chance of victory in the second. But the actual margin, Jake Pickle recalls, was so imposing. How could it possibly be overcome? Making up 70,000 votes in 5 weeks, particularly when we were sure that Coke would get most of Petty's vote too, it seemed impossible, absolutely impossible, Joe Kilgore says. Talked to a dozen Johnson aides about their feelings after the first primary, and one adjective recurs in almost every conversation. Hopeless. And this assessment was, in the privacy of the big backyard at Johnson's Dillman Street house, echoed by the candidate himself. Because local candidates would not be running, the pool of votes to draw from would be much smaller than in the first primary. People do not come out to vote for a United States senator, Johnson explained to Busby. They come out to vote for the sheriff or the county commissioner. Most discouraging was that Johnson's percentage of the vote had been so low, 34%. The June Belden poll had predicted Johnson's share of likely voters at 37%. Despite the helicopter, despite the money, despite the frantic efforts of the past month, despite that month's intensified deluge of radio broadcasts and newspaper ads, Johnson had made no appreciable gain in the last month of the campaign. One explanation might be that, in conservative Texas, a percentage in the mid-30s represented the upper limit of Johnson's potential vote. Asked for a comment on the first primary, Stevenson said laconically, "I think Johnson has pulled his weight." There was another possible explanation as well. For more than a month before the first primary, unprecedented amounts of money had been devoted to persuading voters that Coke Stevenson had made a secret deal to help repeal the Taft-Hartley law. Coke had hardly bothered to reply. The charge he told intimates wasn't true, but he didn't have to bother telling the voters that. They knew it without his telling them. The people of Texas, he said, wouldn't believe that charge no matter how often it was made. They wouldn't believe it because they knew him. They knew his record. They knew what he stood for. They knew what he would do in the future because they knew what he had done in the past. He had never betrayed them before, and he would never betray them now. And they knew that. Coke Stevenson's belief flew, of course, in the face of all conventional political wisdom. But, it now appeared, he had been right. Chapter 12. All or Nothing. 1 month to go. 1 month to make up 70,000 votes. 1 month to make Petty's staunchly conservative followers turn against Coke Stevenson, symbol of conservatism. 1 month for Lyndon Johnson to save his political career. His entire life, it seemed, had boiled down to August 1948. And he couldn't even use his mighty weapon. "We were too far behind," Busby says. trying to draw crowds in little towns, that wasn't going to get you anywhere. We had to go into the cities. The cities, where a helicopter could not be used. Every sacrifice had to be made, even one that may have been especially difficult, ending the abuse of helpless subordinates. Wirtz and Wilde had been attempting for months to persuade Johnson to modify or at least conduct in private the explosions of violent, obscene rage at his staff, and indeed at non-staffers such as hotel waiters and desk clerks, which often took place in full view of local supporters. From town after town, reports came in of tirades so shocking and unforgettable that they often negated all his efforts. But the suggestions from Austin that he abuse his assistants only in private had been ignored, as if the prerogative of venting his emotions at Mary Rather and Woody and Buzz, whenever and wherever he felt like it, was a necessity he could not deny himself. Now, however, there was 1 month to go. He altered his behavior with his customary thoroughness. The first witness to, and beneficiary of, the transformation was Horace Busby. Immediately after the first primary, the young press release writer and idea man had been summoned from his desk on the first floor of the Hancock House, upstairs to where the big shots were meeting. There he received rather unwelcome news. He had been absolutely correct when he reported that the unprecedented size of Johnson's entourage was antagonizing voters, he was told. It had therefore been decided that on future campaign trips the candidate would be accompanied by only a single aide. And guess who it's going to be? Busby says he was designated for the assignment because I had developed a reputation for handling his rages better than anyone else. But he says he had done the handling partly by becoming very good at never being in his line of sight when an explosion was imminent. As Johnson's sole companion, assigned to be constantly at the candidate's side, he would no longer be able to use that tactic. I was, he recalls, expecting the worst. Therefore, he says he was shocked when Johnson was different than he had been during the first primary. Their next trip alone together was to El Paso, and on the plane, I was stunned. We were sitting side by side reading papers, and he was subdued. There was none of the volatility. We actually conversed. But even greater was his surprise at Johnson's behavior when they arrived at their hotel. Since their registration had been arranged in advance, Johnson could have gone straight up to his room, as had been his previous practice, but instead he went over to the desk clerk. "I'm Congressman Johnson," he said with a pleasant voice and smile. "You have a very fine hotel here. I've stayed in it before, and I'm looking forward to this visit." When the bellboy arrived in their suite with the luggage, Johnson told him, "I'd like to shake hands with you if your hands weren't so busy." When the bellboy put down the luggage, Johnson shook his hand. "Buzz," he said, "give the young man a tip." Then he changed his mind. "Son," he said, "he's a cheap tipper. I don't want him tipping you." And, Busby recalls, he gave him $5. And nothing prepared Busby for what was to happen the next morning. Johnson's first appearance would be an early morning meeting, and he told Busby to get up at 4:15 a.m., so that he would have time to bring him coffee. The hotel operator failed to make the wake-up call, however. Busby was awakened at 4:45 a.m., not by the desk, but by his boss. He was awakened gently. Johnson was sitting beside his bed. He wasn't mad, Busby recalls. "Here, Buzz," Lyndon Johnson said. "I went down and got a coffee and donut for you." For the entire month of August, Johnson rarely lapsed from his new code of behavior. Dressing for a dinner speech, Busby says, "He put in his own cufflinks. I didn't have any of the valet services to perform that I was ill-disposed toward performing." Suddenly, Lyndon Johnson was taking care of himself, and there were few, if any, explosions. He was a changed man. On Monday morning, July 26th, both candidates left for Washington. Johnson for the special session of the Do-Nothing 80th Congress that President Truman had called to focus attention on its failures. Stevenson, in order to counter Johnson's charges that he couldn't be an effective senator because he had no ties in the Capitol, for a brief visit to old friends like Tom Connolly in the congressional delegation. Lyndon Johnson's political genius had always enabled him to see opportunities for political gain where no one else saw them. He saw one now in Stevenson's trip to his turf, and he had a reporter Stevenson trusted casually ask the former governor to hold a press conference while he was in Washington. "Sure," Stevenson said. Stevenson, who had no faith in planes, "I never drove in anything with a motor that I didn't have to get out at least once to fix it." traveled to the capital by train. Johnson flew, so he got there 2 days before Stevenson, and by the time Stevenson arrived, the trap had been set. Johnson was well aware by now how Stevenson's pride could be turned against him. Since he would always refuse to defend himself against a hostile question, particularly one asked in an insulting tone, simply ask him a hostile question, and when he refused to reply, accuse him of dodging the issue. The question Johnson was most anxious for Stevenson to appear to dodge, of course, was on Taft-Hartley. "So," says John Connolly, "we encouraged Marshal McNeil," Washington correspondent of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, who had this very abrasive way of asking questions, to ask Coke where he stood on Taft-Hartley. Johnson wanted the whole press conference abrasive, and he made sure that other friends in the Washington press corps knew what questions to ask and how to ask them. He told these friends that Coke Stevenson had been just another one of Texas's crooked governors, that he had, in fact, sold pardons just like Jim Ferguson before him. He told them Stevenson was a caveman, a Neanderthal, ignorant, isolationist, reactionary, a country bumpkin like Papio Daniel. He told them that Stevenson had struck a secret deal with labor bosses to help repeal Taft-Hartley, and that he had been frantically dodging reporters' questions about that issue in Texas. He told them he hoped they wouldn't let Stevenson get away with such tactics in Washington. Johnson not only primed, I would say he had briefed them thoroughly on this man, Coke Stevenson, whom they had never heard of and never seen. Jake Pickle says, "It boiled down to the reporters actually asking and popping the questions and then riding it." By the time Stevenson arrived in Washington, the reporters were waiting for him. Mr. Johnson and his friends, reporters like Drew Pearson, had the stage set. Hostile press conferences were rare in Washington in that era. This press conference, one reporter was to write, was the most hostile in recent memory. Hardly had it begun when Leslie Carpenter, a Washington correspondent for several Texas newspapers, including the pro-Johnson Dallas Times-Herald — Carpenter's wife Liz was a correspondent for other Texas papers — asked a question that attacked the former governor's integrity. "Is the large number of pardons granted in your governorship an issue in this campaign?" Carpenter demanded. Bob Murphy, who had accompanied his uncle to Washington, saw Coke's jaw set and knew what was coming. "I wouldn't know," Stevenson replied coldly. Johnson's charges about the pardons had been exposed as false in Texas, and the issue laid to rest there. But here in Washington it was raised again, in rapid-fire questions often couched in a sneering tone more suited to a prosecuting attorney interrogating an obviously guilty defendant. Reporters in Austin had become accustomed to Stevenson's deliberate way of answering questions, the slow drawl in which he always spoke, and had learned to wait for his replies. These reporters didn't wait, and while he was framing a reply to one question, they would be shouting others at him. Stevenson attempted once to explain that they were mistakenly lumping together pardons with 3 or 5 day clemencies, during which prisoners were allowed to return home for a relative's funeral or a family emergency, but the reporter seemed not to understand. The tone did not change when the questioning, led by Carpenter and young, aggressive Jack Anderson, a Drew Pearson leg man, shifted to Taft-Hartley. Carpenter asked, "Do you think the Taft-Hartley law is a good or a bad law?" Stevenson replied that the issue was too complicated to be answered by simply calling a law good or bad, but every time he attempted to explain his more complex view of the issue, Carpenter interrupted him by simply repeating the same question. He did so 5 times until Stevenson said, "That's a loaded question." Stevenson added, evidently referring to the statement he had made in Abilene on July 3rd, that he had made a statement on Taft-Hartley and the reporters could look it up. That evening, the pack of journalists again crammed into Stevenson's hotel room. Carpenter said that his paper could find no record in its files of his statement on Taft-Hartley, implying that Stevenson had lied. Then the reporter demanded, "Do you think the Taft-Hartley law is a good or a bad law?" Stevenson lost his temper. "I'm not going to let the Times-Herald shape up my campaign," he said. Then the Dallas News was to report Stevenson was also hammered at by Jack Anderson. Anderson's questions were couched in a tone that Stevenson was to liken to cross-examination. Murphy was to say no one was going to cross-examine him. He was determined not to reply to questions asked in that tone. When Pearson's legman demanded, "What did you say about the Taft-Hartley law?" Stevenson angrily said only, "I couldn't repeat it from memory." "Could you give us the gist of it?" Anderson asked. "I might be able to," Stevenson said, "but I don't see any value in it." Stevenson's determination not to reply led him only into deeper and deeper trouble. When Anderson kept demanding a reply, "All I want is a yes or no," Stevenson refused to give one, and when Anderson demanded to know why, he said, "Because you all catch me here away from my notes and put me under cross-examination." "Well," Anderson said, "it seems like a simple thing to remember how you stand." "The people of Texas know," Stevenson replied. The questioning by Anderson, Carpenter, and McNeil was finally stopped by other more neutral reporters who found their colleagues' tactics repugnant. When Anderson said, "It appears to me you're trying to carry water on both sides, Governor," another reporter, Bascom and Timmons, objected, even though he also represented a pro-Johnson paper. "That's an unethical question," Timmons said. Sarah McClendon, who represented the Beaumont Enterprise and the El Paso Times, as well as other Texas papers, and who was already known as a fiery questioner herself, was to say of that press conference, "It was lousy. It was one of the lousiest things I ever saw." Johnson would have been pleased by the tone of the questions at the press conference. He must have been pleased, too, by the tone of the stories that stemmed from it. The lead on Leslie Carpenter's article in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, for example, was that Stevenson Tuesday dodged a direct question asked 5 times as to whether he considered the Taft-Hartley labor law to be a good law or a bad law. Liz Carpenter's article in the Austin American Statesman said that 12 newsmen tried for 20 minutes to get an answer from him on the question. The cooperation of some of the reporters with the Johnson campaign did not end with the filing of their stories. While Stevenson was on a train back to Texas, Leslie Carpenter was dictating a message to Johnson suggesting follow-up questions. "Why don't you get some favorable reporter to ask Stevenson something like this? If Stevenson says no, have the reporter say..." Then the reporter could say, "I think we can start the whole thing over with questions like this. Good luck and God bless you." Marshall McNeil was drafting a statement about Stevenson for Johnson to deliver. The press conference became a pivotal point of the campaign because of money and what money could buy. More money had been poured into Johnson's campaign than had ever been donated to a politician in Texas, but that money was gone now, spent. More money could be raised, however, for by this time, even if Herman Brown had wanted to cut his losses, he couldn't. He was in too deep. None of the group whose fortunes were tied to Brown and Root, and therefore to Lyndon Johnson, could back out now. All of them were in too deep. They knew it. More than a few of the younger members of Johnson's team felt that their chief should seriously consider bowing out of the race without running in the second primary, so hopeless did they consider his position. But when one of them, Wilton Woods, ventured to raise that possibility to Alvin Wirtz, Wirtz replied, not with his customary smile, but with a snarl, "He's got to run it out now. There are too many people out on a limb now." Johnson's personal attacks on Coke Stevenson, so beloved a figure in Austin, had infuriated not only the former governor, but his longtime friends and allies in the state legislature and bureaucracy, who, as Austin lobbyists like Wirtz and Ed Clark knew, would be less restrained in their use of governmental powers than Coke would be. There was, Clark recalls, real hatred for Lyndon Johnson in the corridors of the state capitol. Clark, who had been aware when he had cast his lot with Lyndon Johnson 5 months before that, if I lost, I was going to be through, I was going to be out, now had additional fears. Now, he recalls, he was afraid that we might be in trouble. They were going to punish us if they could. Asked whether some Brown and Root officials were afraid of being indicted, Clark replied, "That might happen. If you're in power, people will say what you want them to say." George Brown was to recall decades later that he and his brother feared that the bitterness engendered in Austin by the campaign might even endanger the continuation of the state road-building contracts that Brown and Root had been receiving for decades. After a normal campaign, Brown was to say, a reconciliation could be expected, but this campaign had been too bitter, and their opponent was too tough for them to expect that. In that second primary, he said, it was all on the line. George and Herman had escaped, narrowly escaped, indictment on federal income tax charges for their financing of Lyndon Johnson's first senatorial campaign, largely, perhaps only, because they had a friend in power in Washington. In the second campaign, they had multiplied their illegalities, and if Lyndon Johnson lost, who would be their friend in power? This book is continued on Cassette 10, Side 1.